In a letter that he wrote to a friend, Galileo wrote that in his scientific discoveries, he learned more with the help of divine grace than with these telescopes. I mean, is that amazing? You know, Galileo was very proud of his telescopes.
Hi, I'm Brandon Nappy.
Hi, I'm Hannah Black.
And we're your hosts on The Leader's Way, an audio pilgrimage from Berkeley Divinity School, the Episcopal Seminary at Yale University.
On this journey, we reflect on what matters most in life as we talk about all things spirituality, innovation, leadership, and transformation.
Hey, Hannah.
Hey, Brandon. How's it going?
It's going well in this wintry April.
Yeah.
Here in New Haven.
Yeah, I'm ready for the sun to break through once and for all.
Yeah, I am clinging to Easter hope.
Yeah.
Amid what feels like Lenten weather.
Mm-hmm. It's Easter on the inside.
Thank you. I'm going to remember that.
And in fact, it was Easter last night at the Berkeley Community Eucharist when we decided to enjoy the tiramisu as much as possible.
Yeah, I feel like we stumbled upon some perennial wisdom here. When in doubt,
eat the tiramisu.
You eat the tiramisu. I mean, can you imagine a scenario in which that's not the case?
No.
And it was quality tiramisu, as somewhat of a tiramisu connoisseur. So.
Yeah, I kind of figured you'd have tiramisu opinions, which is why when you were enjoying it, I thought I must partake.
Okay, unpopular opinion here. I don't think Italians do dessert well.
Oh, wow.
I know.
Oh my goodness. I'm taken aback.
I say that as an Italian-American, Italian on both sides, Southern Italian, Sicilian, and Roman. But I do think that tiramisu is an exception.
Oh, it's so good. And gelato?
Yeah, fair enough. I think about gelato as its own food category separately.
It's a snack.
It can be eaten for breakfast. It's not a dessert. Okay, so fair enough. Gelato, tiramisu. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to critique the cannoli. I'm not a big fan of cannolis.
I see that. What is your favorite dessert?
Oh, I am going to be uncharacteristically kind of patriotic on this one. It's strawberry shortcake.
Oh, wow.
Like, that's like an American dessert.
I thought for a second you were headed in a pie direction, which reminded me that has to be my favorite dessert.
Oh, what kind of pie?
Any fruit pie. I go through pie baking. What's the word? I keep calling everything an era. Like, I was teaching a class the other day and described the church as our Holy Spirit era. So I was going to say I have pie eras.
I'm not the only one with a little Taylor influence going on. Yep. For the record, this is the first podcast with a Taylor Swift reference that I did not initiate. Okay. We are, I think, fully off the rails.
Yeah. Did you have some extraterrestrial musings to share?
Well, of course, this is a really fun conversation that we had with astronomer, astrophysicist Graziella Zinn. And I've been thinking a lot about this conversation because I've been watching Three Body Problem on Netflix, which is a sci-fi thriller. The stars feature very prominently. Extraterrestrial life is a big apocalyptic threat. And so I'm thankful for this conversation with Graziella, because we take the big questions to the big people.
So true.
And questions of the stars and the origins of the universe and God's work through creation and extraterrestrial life do come up in this conversation rather organically.
Yeah, very inspiring. I feel like after listening to this episode, one should go stargaze a little bit. And actually, this is being released right after the eclipse.
Right.
So we should have opened by saying happy eclipse to you.
Yes, absolutely. And I would encourage everyone to stargaze with a gelato. because, of course, Graziella Zinn is our favorite Italian astrophysicist, and you're going to hear a lot of her beautiful Venice accent in her poetic descriptions of the universe. So she's someone who sort of is one part poet and one part scientist. So I'm really excited for that.
Yeah, I don't know what could make stars better except for gelato, and I don't know what could make gelato better except for stars. So that's the challenge for this week, is to stargaze while consuming gelato.
All right, mission accepted. Welcome, Dr. Graziella Zinn, here on the podcast. This is an amazing moment, not only because I know we're going to have a really rich conversation, but because we have known each other for over a decade, maybe almost
20 years.
20 years.
Yeah.
This is amazing. And I'm trying to remember our first moment of meeting. And I think, you tell me if my memory is correct, that we were in a writing and prayer group and we were preparing a kind of commentary on the lectionary for small Christian communities.
Yes, the famous Quest booklet, the name was Quest. Yes.
Yes. And I am just so thankful that our paths have, on many occasions, crossed over the years, and we've been able to collaborate on faith and the stars. And you've just been a really, really rich, vibrant light in my life. Even when we're not connected, I think of you and I think of your work, and it's meant so much to me, as I know it's meant so much to others.
Oh, thank you, Brenda. Anyway, I want to thank you for you and Hannah to inviting me to this very special community, passionate seeker and inspiring leaders.
So one of the great blessings of this podcast is we get to hear the vocation story of leaders, poets and philosophers and theologians and priests and musicians. And I would love to hear, in your words, Graziella, you tell us the story of your faith and your professional work with the stars.
Well, it was a long, quiet journey. They started when I was in first grade. A little time ago, I was blessed to have an amazing teacher who knew how to inspire young girls to appreciate the beauty of creation in all its expression, from flowers to stars. I remember vividly the very beginning of my astronomical journey. It was late winter, at the time when the planet Venus would appear in the western sky as the evening star, just after sunset. The teacher encouraged the whole class not to miss that spectacular sight, and it was unforgettable. A huge sparkling diamond piercing the blue velvet of the sky over the water. It was a true epiphany for my young exploring mind. For me, that was the revelation that the night sky is the most beautiful sight to contemplate. And I did it in my own simple way. Now is the story. My family lived on the harbor, facing 180 degrees of the Venetian Lagoon. Spectacular. Without any barrier against the night sky. In the clear nights, before going to bed, I started the habit to look out of my bedroom and search for the stars over the lagoon. They became a ritual for my evening prayers. Growing up, I would enhance my evening quiet time by taking a walk along the pier under the embrace of the stars, contemplating in prayer for silence that mystical beauty, a feeling closer and closer to God, the eternal beauty. I developed also a deeper sense of gratitude to be part of God's wonderful creation. Then, later on, when I went to the university, it was natural for me to enrich my faith-filled dialogue with the universe by learning and researching its science story. And I became a professional astronomer.
It's amazing. You know, we have so lost our connection to the stars in daily life. At least, you know, here in New Haven, there's so much light pollution and it's so easy to forget to look up.
Yes, yes.
And I wonder, Graziella, what is it that we lose when we forget that we're connected to this incredible universe beyond the Earth?
Yes, it's a big loss. But because you said something, we forget to look up. I just want to share quickly first. One of my students, he was actually a political science major. He was a senior, so we were the last semester. At the end of the course, he came to me, he said, you know, taking this course, for the first time, I took opportunity to look up at the star when I was walking through campus. I never did in 4 years. So he said, I'm taking the summer off. I'm postponing my job in Florida. And they said, I want to take time to enjoy creation. So they tell us, I think, that yes, it's a big loss. I would say a fundamental loss. Since stargazing has been a most primordial and essential human experience. Sun, moon, and stars with their patterns and their cycle in the sky have guided the development of ancient civilization, with the creation of calendars for the agricultural season, maps for the direction of their migrations, orientation for the sacred sites of their religious ritual. Ancient astronomical history has been discovered by all the archaeoastronomy findings. So we know that this happened for sure. Think about Stonehenge. It is the most famous example of astronomical religious site in Stonehenge. Maybe you saw because you were in England. That impressive prehistoric monument on the Salisbury Plain in England, thought to be around 5,000 years old. Its massive standing stone, placed in circular arrangement, appear aligned with certain seasonal positions, sun, moon, and star. Unfortunately today, thousands of years later, the vast majority of people living in our modern cities are denied the enchantment of a night sky. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, starlight has been washed out by the effect of light pollution. You know, and there is a 10% yearly increase, 10%, at the point that now 80% of the world's population live under sky glow, with no stars visible.
Wow.
You can go in darksky.org. You can find all the instruction, all the information about light pollution. So we can put a link if it's good. And they give all kind of instruction, and we can reduce it at least a little bit. And then we can have a public policies, talk with the city government and do something. I just would like to share another reflection before we end this. Does light pollution have anything to do with fate? I think it does. Because the mystical beauty of the starry sky connects the human soul with the creator of the beauty, who is the eternal beauty. And when we lose that connection, as you were saying, Brandon, and I'm thinking especially of the young people, the human spirit is deprived of a fulfilling relationship with the universe. It's to be fulfilling. I'm not talking about the virtual relationship that we are using today, but a real one. A personal one, this to go beyond photos, video, and books, picture, they're very good. But we need a real faith-filled experience that touch our heart. So now, we all have a responsibility for this. I mean, something to ponder. It's not just the responsibility of astronomers.
Oh my goodness. It reminds me so much of Dante. And it reminds me also of a really amazing trip I took with some of my friends once to Zion National Park, which was the first time I was out there camping. And it's the first time I could see the Milky Way with the naked eye. And it's just, I mean, there's something about that that's so profound, like you're saying.
You don't find a substitute to that experience.
Yeah.
I think we need to understand that. You know, we have five little grandchildren. I mean, what kind of sky are they finding when they are old? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. Speaking of your grandchildren, Brandon has told me that you have described the universe as a family. Can you tell me about that?
Well, Brandon is a very good memory. Let's face it. Okay. Yes. When I give presentation to the public, I like to show connection between our human life experience and the cosmic life experience. I think it gives more a sense of belonging. One example is the connection between our human social nature, our family structure, and the visible social character diffused throughout the universe. There is. How do we know that? We have learned about the cosmic aggregation that we could describe as families. from extended astronomical sky surveys. We don't make this up. There are observation, and we found this. They have shown the stars, which are the basic building blocks of the observable universe, tend to form in groups as pair or multiple system or association, or even very large star clusters, like the one we showed in the beginning, up to hundreds of thousands of stars. Also galaxies, which are the fundamental unit of the larger scale structure of the universe, are mostly found in groups or larger clusters. And here we talk about a thousand of galaxies. So it's really kind of multi-families and multi-communities cosmic fabric. Yes, Brandon remember well. Moreover, the universe has a cycle of life and death for all its components. Well, you know, you talk about Dante, you know, they thought the stars were eternal, but that was the cosmology of the time, and not the fault of Dante. I mean, science moves slowly. Just like human families do through generation, go through generation and generation.
Oh, wow.
Okay, maybe if I want to explain a little bit in the case of the stars. They are born in clouds of cold gas and dust following gravitational collapses. They go through life changing and evolving as they age. I do that too. Well, we all do. And eventually they die, just like people do. Also, stars leave a legacy. Actually, a most important one. We learn the stars are cosmic furnaces, burning hydrogen and helium into heavier elements, creating most of the chemical elements of the periodic table. When we studied chemistry in high school, no one told me they were all made in the stars.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and the order of that table, if you have a recollection, is amazing. It is perfect.
My memory, Graziella, is I would look at that periodic table and just cry because I didn't understand any of it. So I love how excited you're getting because it was a source of suffering for me.
It's amazing. Okay, so what's happening then? Oh, at the end of their lives, the elements forged in their interior will be scattered throughout space. And they are up in two ways, both in the evolutionary phase of planetary nebula, like our sun will do. These are the medium-sized stars. Or in the explosion of supernova. These are the massive stars. The one that we saw in that brilliant cluster, very massive, they will die soon, in a few million years, and they will die with an explosion of supernova, a tremendous firework. So we are talking about a cosmic recycling. You think we invented now? No. Was there for billions of years? Yeah. So, because every time the newly ejected stardust, see how fascinating the people say the stardust, is used to form the next generation of stars and planets. Eventually, stardust will process and make its way into the chain of nutrients that form and sustain living bodies on a planet, if they are there. In particular, our human bodies on the planet Earth. So our sun, for example, is a third generation star. Only old 4.5 billion years. Okay. So we are all interconnected. That's why I say we are really a family in the fabric of cosmic life down to the star. This is another good reason to appreciate the star. So anyway, we have to remember, see, when we say, so we are stardust, I remember, you know, the Carl Sagan was keep saying that, which is fascinating to say. And in some way it's true, but we have to remember we are above all that because we are created in the image of God. We can stop at the stardust. So we can repeat this famous slogan. Yes, I am stardust, but only in a limited sense because we are more precious than that in the eyes of our Creator. So that's where you see the interplay of faith and astronomy keep coming close and close.
Okay. I'm so sorry. This isn't even a science question. It's a Disney question.
It's okay. So- I'm still a human being.
Hannah has been waiting to ask a Disney question for the history of the podcast.
Oh my. Well,
I try to push it down, Brandon. Okay, so there's the newest Disney movie is called Wish, and it's about wishing on a star. And there's a whole song. I just pulled it up so I could read you the lyrics because I want to know what you think.
Sure.
It says, well, you don't have to look too hard. It's all around you and not too far. If you're trying to find out just who you are, you're a star. Do you know you're a work of art, even in the deepest dark? If you really want to know just who you are, I'm a star. And I was with my mother-in-law watching this, and we were like, this is the worst theological anthropology I've ever heard.
Unfortunately, I agree.
Well, okay. But then a week later, we actually, Brandon and I were at a service at Yale Divinity School where there were a lot of reflections about being made of stardust and this kind of thing. So tell me, how does this work?
Well, I think, as I just mentioned, we don't get to stop there.
Right.
So it's just the beginning. Like, for example, in the book that we will talk later about the book, I try to connect with Genesis, you know, and not to be, I don't believe in concordism. I don't believe that the Bible is to concord with science at all. They are two different ways of understanding reality. Mm-hmm. But just to stay, you know, the Lord took the dust of the ground, right?
Yes.
And that dust came from stardust. I mean, no way.
Oh, wow.
So no way. It was a process, was elaborated, were all kind of remanaging, or kind of other, you know, life that come and grow. So there are death in life, as I just said, there was a recycling. But in the beginning, the very original dust was formed in the stars.
Mm-hmm.
So it is fascinating in the sense that when the Bible tells us the very deep meaning of human life, does really contradict the meaning of science. We have to talk about meaning. We never talk about details. See, never talk about the particularity. That would be very wrong. Because the day that we found something a little different, then our faith seems to collapse. So that was the problem with Newton in some way, because he thought, you know, he believed in this gravitational force. And he said, well, the universe doesn't collapse because God holds us. I mean, then we find out there is all kinds of different forces holding the universe. So he said, the answer is, we don't need God, like Laplace said. No, that would be the wrong way of going.
Right.
So going back to your Disney song, it sounds pretty fascinating. Well, it's not completely true, I would say that.
Right.
And that actually, I found the limitation when I was teaching a lot of my students, which were not a science major. I did a teacher sort of for non-science major. I wanted to focus in concepts, not in formulas for them, right? Because you remember concept, you don't remember formula very well.
Totally.
So I realized that they were learning a lot from science fiction. And that was a problem. There was a real problem because they were seeing the reality in a fantastic way. Maybe one day we will find things, but let's move step by step.
Right.
This is really fun. You know, I'm wondering what it's been like, Graziella, to be a person of faith in your field. You know, as an astronomer, I presume that in your academic community, there may be lots of people who have faith. There may be lots of people who are pretty insistent that faith and science can't have a complementary relationship. And so I wonder how that's been for you as a Christian. And especially I'm thinking about our leaders who are church leaders, they're rectors and pastors of parishes, and they are frequently, as leaders, in rooms and throughout the community with people who don't have faith. And so I just wonder if you could tell the story about your own faith and professional life and what it's been to be a part of conversations when your faith hasn't always been shared.
Right. Well, I can say this at the beginning. I always try to be myself. I don't escape from my reality of a believer. I try to be gentle and understanding and very respectful. Like the course I taught recently, one of the persons was an atheist. At the end, we had a conversation which can be difficult, but kind. And in the end, he wrote to me a note. He said, I'm really grateful that you only respect my point of view. I think that's important. I don't have to convince anybody. It's only the grace of God that operates. But I have to be a witness. If I hide myself behind convenience, I will really fail to be who I am. First, I'm deeply grateful for the gift of faith that I received the baptism. I think that was really special. And I thank my parents that to offer my life back to God. I know now many times I have friends and they say, oh, let the child decide when he's old. And I do feel sorry for the child. I know it's not my responsibility, obviously. Oh, I can't even think of a life without faith because I never experienced it. God was always there when I had the humility to ask for his help. And also when I was too distraught to have the energy to ask for. Looking back, I see that in one way or another, God always reminded me that he was on my side. At times, I understood that only later. How did I transfer this faith experience in my scientific career? I think that it came natural, but also intentional. Because sometimes I had to make an effort, guided by prayer, to remind myself that my Christian values were above any scientific accomplishments or any scientific competition. It came down to a matter of priorities, like honor God and love your neighbor. I have learned to consider Jesus' words reported in Matthew 6:33, seek first the kingdom of God, and everything else will be given to you. It's a powerful motto. Hope is not a disrespectful word, motto, also for a scientist. The rest belong to God. It will be given in the right way, at the right time. Actually, I have another motto, specifically for astronomers and for Latin lovers. Deus creatorem venite adoremus. Come, let us adore God, the creator. I don't have ownership for this motto. It is carved on the wall at the entrance of the Vatican Observatory headquarters at Castel Gandolfo, you know, just outside Rome. I really would recommend this motto also for stargazer. Come, let us adore God, the creator. You know, I heard, Brandon, in one of your episodes, that you're going to Italy soon.
It's true. It's the first time in 25 years.
Yeah, so maybe that's an interesting place to visit.
Oh, my God.
It's just outside of Rome. It's very easy. I think there is a train that goes quickly. Yeah.
Is there? I've never been before.
Oh, now I'm ready to book a trip.
I think especially, actually,
wow,
to see this very ancient observatory. You know, actually, the Vatican Observatory is the ancient modern observatory. It started in the 16th century in Rome by the Jesuit College. Yeah. And they were astronomers. At the time of Galileo, was pretty flourishing.
Well, yeah, this is what I've been thinking as you're talking about your faith and being an astronomer, that I sort of went through theological education in an era where we have all these great theologians wanting to square science and religion and say, actually, you know, a lot of science has come from religion in certain ways. And people like Galileo and Newton sort of were making discoveries from a faith-based framework. How does that sound to your ears, since you know so much more about this than I do?
I think it's a misconception that is provided.
Really?
Absolutely. Yeah, the story of Galileo has been so much distorted. Becomes a myth for some ideological purpose. So I think knowledge is important. That's why when I was talking about in my book about the dialogue, we need to know what we are talking about. We don't want to be taken by the media, the popularity, or whatever we hear on TV or whatever we are reading. We need to know the historical fact, and we have to put everything in context. The famous Galileo affair is really to be understood in context. So that's more important.
Does Galileo show up in your book, Astronomy and Faith in Dialogue with the Universe?
Long chapters on Galileo.
Oh, okay, okay. The real Galileo.
It's time to get the story right, and Graziella sets us all straight.
I know. Anyway, this famous Galileo, I think you asked me, how do I see this? Did you ask me the relationship between faith and science?
Yeah.
Well, I have to tell you, in my work as a scientist, in my faith journey as a believer, I never felt I had to choose between the discoveries of astronomy and the belief of my Christian faith. What I knew, that I had just to acknowledge where their authority ended, recognize that they are different kinds of knowledge with a different purpose. That's why I did not see any conflict between the two. But also, I did not expect that they had to prove each other either. See, that would be the mistake. Their views are just complementary. This perspective, not just my own, is shared by many scientists. Sometimes they are quiet about, or they do speak up, fortunately. It is a powerful example of a believer who was also a pioneer of science, is offered by Father Georges Lemaître. Not many people know him. Do you, Hannah?
Mm-mm.
You, Brando? After all the time I talk, this is the only family?
There's so much I don't know, and there's more by the moment that I'm ignorant of.
You remember Big Bang, they ring you a bang.
Oh, he's the Big Bang dude.
Yes.
Okay. I'm with you now.
Okay. So Father John Lemaître was the Belgian physicist and Catholic priest. Okay, people don't know he was a Catholic priest who first developed the Big Bang model for the beginning of the universe. See?
Mm.
He said that. He said very clearly, once you realize that the Bible does not claim to be a textbook of science, the old controversy between religion and science vanishes. So we need to know what we are looking for. This is crystal clear. So that's important. Unfortunately, there is a mistaken common perception about a supposed conflict between faith and science that is fostered by modern secularism.
Yeah.
And thrives in misconception, like the one that we talk about to Galileo. And they think religion is an obstacle for the development of science. When there is an incredible long list of pioneers, and I think I mentioned something in the book, of pioneers of science, they were absolutely believers, really committed believers. So unfortunately, this materialistic vision considers only science the way to arrive at the truth. They are missing completely the purpose of creation, you see, and the real meaning of the human life. Everything becomes disposable. And that's sad. That's really sad. Because, you see, science can only answer the what, the when, and the how of a physical reality.
Yeah.
Never answer the whys.
Oh, my God.
See, they belong to a different level of knowledge. They belong to philosophy and theology and religion. They need the introspection. They don't need the empirical proofs. You cannot prove those things empirically.
No, that's so helpful. And it's so simple when you say it like that, even communicating with students or whoever, to say, well, the Bible is not trying to answer what, it's trying to answer why.
Right.
Science is limited to the five senses, really.
Yeah, I mean, the scientific method that Galileo really pointed out so clearly. I studied in Padova, so I really was immersed in that. It's fascinating. He really knew what it means to do science, but he also knew what it means to be a faithful believer.
This is blowing my mind because I grew up in a very conservative environment where the Big Bang was presented as like something that some people believe, but actually it's an enemy of religion and God. And the way you're presenting it is like, no, no, no.
We don't know if it happened in that way. I mean, let's right. face it. It's not an event, it's a model. And as all the scientific model, it has a limited life. But it's the model that explains what we observe. So there is no other way. If maybe, you know, now we have this Webb telescope that is incredible, whatever we will put in orbit again in the future, maybe we will discover something different that will contradict a little bit this model. Then we have to amplify and refurbish the model. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Science is not the reality. Science studies the reality.
Yeah.
Gives interpretation of the realities. I'm a scientist and I trust science, but I know its limits.
Yeah.
Some say the Big Bang, if you see as a model, as a theory, which is proved by many, many facts, it seems that it's valid. We don't have an alternative.
Mm.
And it does explain a lot.
This is very refreshing. I'm very excited about all of this.
Good, good.
So I love the kind of partnership between faith and science that you're describing that lives inside of you, it sounds like, in this really, really vibrant way. And I wonder if you would help me, because I had this experience over the summertime when I needed an astrophysicist to intervene. I had this one experience, and it raised two important questions. My whole family came out into the backyard, and we're all gathered together, And we had this beautiful fire, and we were just enjoying being outside together for hours and hours. The fire died down. We looked up and saw this marvelous sky of stars, and we saw what all of us concluded was a UFO sighting for about 1 minute. And it was six or seven lights that were all blinking at the same time. You know, a few minutes later, we looked this up, and this is one of Elon Musk's Starlink satellites. But if you've ever seen them, there's like six of them all at once strung together. And so my first question is, what are we doing about all of the junk that we have launched out into space? There are 10,000, almost 10,000 satellites out there.
I know.
And I was thinking about what you said, Graziella, that if in fact the universe is one of the ways that we have relationship with our creator, mm-hmm. What does it mean that we're sending junk out into the universe and it's literally in the way of us experiencing what the creator has created? And I'm just wondering if you could think about first about space junk, and then we'll get to aliens later. That's my second question.
So I think we go to the point we discussed before. We don't care. We don't care anymore about stargazing. You know, unfortunately, first we pollute with the light. Now we pollute with all this junk that we space. And we think about just convenience, technology, communication, which is good in some way, I'm saying. I think we don't have a balance of things. Because if you don't, I know, like John Paul II said, we have two wings that we have to fly through light. One is the reason and one is the fate. So if only we think about our own human reasons, we can create all kinds of reasons that we think they're valid, but they are excessive and they are abusive. So I really don't know. We have to create a more conscience, more morality in what we do. I think that's a very important motto that I would say, seek first the kingdom of God, is really true. So are we seeking the kingdom of God when we throw all this in space? People don't ask anymore the question. I think we go to the bottom line. That's always the same. We don't grow up anymore with the sense that we are accountable to God.
Yeah, I was shocked to discover there is no policy, there are no rules, there are no laws governing what we send out into space in terms of debris and refuse.
I think it's very hard to be implemented.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm not sure what they are. I know there are policy if we find ever a connection with some intelligent extra life. And no one can do anything. There is a kind of rules, you know, you can go to harvest anything. I mean, it's complicated, but that's so far away. And I don't know if it ever happens.
Well, I mean, and you mentioned it, and certainly I brought it up too. My kids will be upset if I spent an hour with an astrophysicist and didn't talk about other forms of life. I mean, you must get asked this at every cocktail party you go to.
And I do have a chapter in the book, Are We Alone, actually. Well, we really don't know. The honest answer to your kids, we don't know if we are alone. We could be not alone. We could be alone. Because science is based on proof, we don't have any proof yet. But this new big telescope, the Webb especially, you know, this space telescope, the last one, we already discovered with other instruments in space planets that in principle could be hosting life.
Right.
We are talking about bacterial life. I mean, intelligent life, there is no sign whatsoever with all the years and years of experiment or any technological signal so far. Let's talk only so far. Mm-hmm. So what they are trying now to do, they have to monitor if there is atmosphere. See, we know life only as it happened on this planet. Could be other different kind of life experience that we don't know in the universe. So that's why they are trying now with this project to have a platform on the moon, move to Mars. But it's a very, very long way to go. We know the solar system doesn't host any life. If it does, it's very minimal bacteria somewhere in some ocean below the crust of Europa or other thing. So it seems pretty barren, the solar system. And the next star, which is closer, Proxima Centauri, which is a 4 light year, which means it takes a long time just to the light to get there. I don't remember. I think I find the calculation takes thousands of years for human being, if ever to get there with any instrument, any spacecraft. is even variable star, is even stable. It doesn't have planet. So I really don't know how we can get anywhere. You know, those people, if they're there, they can get here. So space communication is tough. It's good to keep exploring. I'm not against it at all. We should continue because you never know.
Hmm.
We have a lot to do on our planet Earth, actually. What do you think?
That's true.
Plenty to do. So let's not consume all the energy in space.
Well, we keep dancing around your book. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what prompted you to write Astronomy and Faith in Dialogue with the Universe.
Yes. Okay. The idea of a book on the complementarity of astronomy and faith for unveiling the mystery of the universe came to me several years ago, precisely in 2009. At that time, the astronomical community was celebrating the International Year of Astronomy. I don't know if you remember, proclaimed by United Nations General Assembly. The purpose was to honor the astronomical discoveries made by Galileo, our famous Galileo, with his first telescope. And it was 400 years before, so that was the anniversary. That was a momentous event that marked the beginning of modern astronomy in Padova. It changed dramatically our human perception of the universe. When he found that the Milky Way was not just this beautiful stripe of milky thing, of clouds, but just hundreds of stars, he was shocked, you know. So in the midst of all that excitement produced by the presentation, activities, I was part also of the committee at the Department of Astronomy to organize things, and we wanted to celebrate the scientific revolution initiated by Galileo, I did not hear voices praising the deep faith that nourished Galileo's life, as if it was irrelevant, or even worse, not existent. But I knew that was not the case because I studied, I worked for years immersed in the legacy left by Galileo in Padova. And also I read some of his original scripts. For example, in a letter that he wrote to a friend, Galileo wrote that in his scientific discoveries, he learned more with the help of divine grace than with these telescopes. I mean, is that amazing? You know, Galileo was very proud of his telescopes. So was that awareness for me, that Galileo was being presented in a distorted way, and I'm affectionate to Galileo. I feel close to him. Now, the Department of Physics, where I study, I work, is Galileo Galilei. So Galileo was there every single day for me. So that prompted me the desire to write a book, bringing together the faith testimonies of pioneers like Galileo, with their unique scientific accomplishment, they really go together. I realized that in just over 10 years, while the discoveries from the space telescope, yeah, they were becoming more and more popular and appreciated, the personal connection, the one that we talked before, with the starry sky was becoming more irrelevant, both for the growing of light pollution and for the emphasis given by the popular media to the power of the human mind.
Hmm.
Ignoring that every good thing is a gift from God. So that's a really loss. I needed to focus both on discoveries on modern astronomy and on the central tenets of the Christian faith, together with the faith testimony of famous scientists. Can I read the prologue quickly, just the first part? Dear friend, I wrote this book for you. When you search the night sky with wonder, when you search for God in the wonder, when you search for the wonder of truth, we will search together. So I really opened my heart in the prologue. Then I committed myself in the book to provide the readers with the basic scientific and religious objective information. I was thinking especially about beginners. So it's an easy book to read. You don't need any scientific preparation. I want people to become comfortable of entertaining a fruitful dialogue between astronomy and Christian faith. And we have to remember, I am very convinced, that dialogue can only be productive if we know what we are talking about. So are you going to read the book, Hannah?
Yeah, absolutely.
I see. I think Brenda has a copy. I'm very happy to send you one.
Oh, it's so lovely. So lovely. I have a crazy question for you before we have more sincere questions for you. Astrology, Is it good? Is it neutral? Is it evil? What's the deal?
Well, I don't judge anything evil per se, because it depends on what's in the heart of the person. So I think most of the time it's ignorance. Believe or not, the Yale student, I mean, sad to say, I had a class, I would say maybe one third half were looking at the horoscope. So we had a normal work one time. I gave to them, you know when you're born, you take a diary. Don't look at the horoscope this week, ever. Every day, write down what's happening to you. And then after a week, go to check, go back and read the horoscope. Well, they all came back and said, well, it didn't really work. Really? It didn't really work. Yeah, you know, astrology, first it was invented 1,000 years ago by the Babylonia. And they didn't know much about really the scientific method. So we shouldn't accuse them in any way. Like when we talk for us, when we talk about the three kings, that we, for the Epiphany, we call them astrologers. They were the scientists of the time. I mean, they were not people that didn't understand reality. They were looking for, and they were using whatever instrument they had available at that time. But they were open. You see, you need to be open. Also, when your knowledge is limited, be always open. Don't get locked in that. Anyway, going back about astrology, doesn't have any scientific basis for many reasons. First of all, we just learning how the stars are so far away and the planets. How could they have any influence on us? Mm. We don't the law, we know the physical. How could they affect us? They don't. At that time, they believed the cosmic body were divine. You see, that's completely different. That's why Genesis, the story of creation, made a tremendous difference, because those who were created by the eternal divine God, those who were not anymore a divine being. So that's very important. So I think the really message of Genesis is that let's forget about the details. They belong to the understanding of the culture. But the message is very profound. It's God, the creator. Everything else depends on God. So they don't have any power on us, on anything. Of course, there is also a very practical thing. Because of the rotation of the axis of the earth, the sun doesn't rise anymore in the constellation that we say the month of the zodiac. So, yeah, it's even, okay. So when you say you're a Capricorn, you know, even more Capricorn. I mean, the whole thing is a little messy. I would recommend the young people, especially, just forget about astrology. Is it time of money, of energy, of anxiety? It's the wrong direction, really. So, but it's a choice everybody has to make.
Yeah.
Again, give information. Tell him the truth. Give him the scientific basis. Do you want to be unscientific? Well, that's the choice you make.
I have a burning question.
am I burning yet? No, I'm okay.
And my burning question comes from this observation that, you know, we sometimes caricature the relationship between faith and science. And I think actually scientists and science itself is actually often are the folks who stand in the midst of mystery, most admittedly. And I'm thinking in particular about gravity.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering, maybe you can remind us a little bit about how gravity works, because we know that it works, but we don't really understand it, do we? It's a mystery. Yeah. And so I'm wondering, and maybe I'm not even understanding this correctly, but I'd love you to explain to me how gravity works if we even know that. And if we don't, then it seems to me that scientists are actually quite good at standing in the face of mystery and not knowing.
You said something very important. There are more mysteries in science than answers. And what amazes me all the time, how scientists are very willing to accept the mystery. Think about the dark matter or the dark energy.
Yeah.
But when you start to talk about the mystery of God, they said, it's your invention. So, I mean, really?
Oh,
gosh. Yeah.
Oh, thank you for hearing my question much better than I could ask it. Yeah, go on.
No. So I say we are talking about gravitation is very much dealt at the cosmic level. At the local level, we still talk about the Newtonian force. and it's something that is intrinsic to matter. So that's local. But at the cosmic level, when we talk about these extreme distances, we enter into the realm of general relativity.
Mm-hmm.
So that is really a mathematical tools and vision. Again, as I said before, not necessarily it does happen as we think, but as we think, it does explain the phenomenon. Mm. So we all are in the point like the Big Bang. So there is this tapestry of space and time, the space of space that Einstein Phantom. Actually, the beginning came from Galileo. Einstein was an avid reader of Galileo, and also Newton, because Galileo was the first one to understand the relativity of motion. Nothing is absolute, it's all relative to the observer. Really, Galileo was a pioneer in many, many ways. So he did see anymore the gravitation as really a force, but as a phenomenon that will come in this fabric of space and time. So where there is a mass, there is this warping of space and time. The idea to see space and time connect is very hard for us. Very hard. I was always telling my students, we don't have to understand rationally. We have to trust that it works mathematically.
Hmm.
So again, talking about this famous mystery, that we look at so many theorems and mathematical quote-unquote dogmas, we have to accept, and we don't even prove. You can prove them. They work, and then you use them. I mean, that's really a key thing. So understanding really the nature of gravitation, I would say it is very impossible just to understand the essence of gravitation.
Mm-hmm.
We can understand how it works. As I told you, this warping of space and time, that's what we need to accept, the limitation of our human mind. I don't remember who was, maybe it was Benedict XVI, said the great achievement of the human mind is to understand that it has limitation.
Hmm.
I mean, if we think we can comprehend everything, I think we fool ourselves.
Yeah, yeah.
But we have to work hard. It doesn't mean to sit back on the couch and let things happen by themselves. We have to work hard. I think humility is quite a virtue for everybody. And, you know, talking about the mystery of the dark matter that was brought up and the dark energy, they seem that they're operating some way. That's why we think dark matter exists, because there are so many phenomena that are happening and we don't have any other way to explain to this very extra, enormous quantity of matter. Only 5% in the universe is what we call normal matter. So everything else is dark matter and dark energy. And also this, because now not only now with the Big Bang model, one of the proof of the Big Bang, indeed the universe is in expansion, space is in expansion. How can you understand? I remember one of my students said, where is he expanding?
Great when question. Said,
where? Yeah, not in your backyard. Nowhere. He's expanding in himself. He's just expanding. And the more he's expanding, more space is created. And more space is created. And now with this business of the dark energy, the more it is expanding, the more dark energy is present because it's intrinsic to the space. Okay, so I said, do we need to understand all this? Not really. If you are not working on this model, I mean, if you are, you better make some sense. But if you're just a listener, why? I said, there are so many mysterious things in the universe that tell us of an incredible creator. Okay, then there are the people that want just to disregard the creator. They are famous scientists, actually, very popular. And they said, well, we don't need a God. The law of gravity is what makes the universe exist. Okay. Then I ask, who started the law of gravity? From where is it coming? Oh, we don't need to find where it's coming. Okay, so it's our new divinity then. So if it doesn't come anywhere, is a prime being, you know, so is a prima causa, causa prima. So that's what it is. So you see, you got your kind of contradiction. Bottom line, you need to go to the depth of the truth to move forwards. Otherwise, you are caught in all this labyrinth of your mind. And probably more prayer time, I suppose, would be helpful.
Well, this is exactly what I was hoping to ask. I'm sure Brandon has an ultimate question for you. So let me give you a penultimate question. Before we hit record, you showed us this gorgeous image of where, and you said find the earth in this image and talked about how that affects your prayer life. So I wonder if you could share with our listeners how being an astronomer affects your prayer life.
As I mentioned on the origin of my vocation in astronomy, I find the more peaceful time to prayer, really being alone under the star. You know, I say alone not to be selfish. Sometimes it's good to be in a group, certainly with my family, with my children, absolutely. But sometimes I just need to be by myself. You know, I just feel the embrace, because after all, God decided I could live in this wonderful universe and to be part of this amazing creation. I mean, it's filling me with hope, really true hope, because it's grounded in God. I really would like other people experience. That's why I'm trying to encourage people to take time and feel that embrace of that mystery. Who am I? Who am I? What is all my solitude? What's the purpose? So this question, the very hard that you can ask yourself watching TV. I mean, really, you have to immerse yourself, and it's paying back immensely. So I do hope in this very confusing time, unrestful time, sad time, wars and everything, if more people decided to find the time to place themselves under the stars and the presence of God, because that's a fundamental, then we will create a bridge of solidarity among these. Wherever you go, you find the same star. Is another burning question? Is anything left in me to be burned? I don't know.
You anticipated my question about hope, and you said it just so beautifully. I'm so thankful. You, Graziella, are a star in the constellation of our podcast episodes.
Oh my goodness. A lot of pressure on me.
With the pressure and the burning, it all sounds like star jokes now.
Right. So am I a medium-sized star? I hope a very tiny, because then I live a long time. You know, if I am a very dwarf star, I can live even longer than the sun. But if I'm a big star, please don't. I live a short time, only a few million years. It's too short.
Thank you for listening to The Leader's Way. We hope you were encouraged and inspired. To learn more about this episode, visit our website at berkeleydivinity.yale.edu/podcast.
Rate and review us and follow the podcast to make sure you never miss an episode. Follow Berkeley at Yale on Instagram for quotes from the podcast and more.
Until next time.
The Lord be with you.